In 2019, the journalist Douglas Murray published his book, The Madness of Crowds. And there's something about belonging to a crowd, whether that be a local actual crowd or the crowd of society more generally, I suppose Murray's talking about, that leads otherwise decent people to act like madmen, to do absurd, irrational, and cruel things. And we saw that last time we were in the book of Mark when we looked at that crowd in verses 6 to 15. A crowd of seemingly ordinary people, yet desperate to see this young, innocent Jesus of Nazareth crucified. And yet, I don't think it is simply that being in this crowd turns these ordinary people into mad people. No, on the contrary, actually, crowds also show us what ordinary people are really like. Crowds show us that ordinary people in their natural state are absurd and irrational and cruel. The presence of the crowd around them simply becomes the place where those instincts can rise to the surface and be expressed without any accountability. Finally, people are able to come into their true form and reveal their true colours. And that is once again what we see happening in the passage this evening. In verses 16 to 20, Jesus is thrust into another crowd. Only this time it's a crowd of soldiers. Jesus is led into a palace. We don't know exactly, well, there's some debate about where this palace is. But wherever it is, Mark tells us in verse 16 that the whole battalion is called together for this event. That may well be up to 600 men. 600 men now in this palace are let loose upon Jesus. And this time it's not just any old men, it's Roman soldiers. It's men who are used to being cruel. It's men who are used to being violent, who are used to channeling their anger towards a specific cause. But you see, on this occasion, on this night, those usual restrictions that they're working under most of the time are completely lifted. And all of that suppressed military brutality is now allowed free flow upon the person of Jesus Christ. And that is why this is an ugly scene that takes place before us in these verses. But if we're going to learn from God's word, we're going to have to confront this scene, we're going to have to look at it, we're going to have to study it, and we trust that even in this ugly event, God has much to teach us. And I have 3 points for us this evening. And my first point is this. The man who is mocked. The man who is mocked. Because these soldiers, they don't just hurt Jesus physically. No, they hurt him psychologically. They mock Jesus. They add insult to injury. And it's this mockery of Jesus that I want us to observe in particular this evening. You see, when the religious leaders mocked Jesus in the previous chapter, which they did, there was one particular claim of Jesus that they mocked. It was his claim as a prophet. Prophesy, they said to him as they struck him. Prophesy, who struck you? But for these secular soldiers, it's not the prophetic claims of Jesus that they mock. Jewish religion isn't something they're particularly interested in. It's his kingly claims. Remember how back in verse 2 of chapter 15, Jesus had admitted to the title, King of the Jews. Are you the King of the Jews? Pilate had asked Jesus. You have said so, Jesus replied. Well, perhaps someone was listening to those words from Jesus, because now in verse 18, those words come back to bite him. Hail, King of the Jews, the soldiers mock. It's a reference to the standard salute to Caesar. Hail Caesar! It's obviously sarcastic in this context. And that sarcasm, then, is the defining feature, isn't it, of this whole passage. This is a sarcastic event which takes place. I hardly need to spell that out to you. Because what happens in this passage is a kind of mock coronation. A mock coronation service. We have the mock purple gown put on Jesus. We have the mock crown placed on his head. We have all of this mock saluting. In verse 19, we have the soldiers paying homage to Jesus, and yet that is part of the same list as their striking and their spitting. Their striking and their spitting is no worse than their paying homage, because it's sarcastic. You see, however ignorant these soldiers might be of Jewish religion, they know what it means to be under the command of a king or an emperor. They know what political power is all about, and it's that power which keeps them in line and keeps them on duty and pays their wages. And these soldiers know, as sure as they know the sky is blue, that this little Jewish Jesus does not have that power. And it's hilarious that he would claim it to be the case. And so, relentlessly, in this passage, they poke fun at him. They mock him, and mock him, and mock him, and mock him, and mock him. And they want him to regret that he ever said those silly words about being the king of the Jews. Mockery is a very powerful tool, isn't it? And actually, I don't think mockery is always a bad thing. You see mockery happening in the Bible in a positive sense. I don't really mean positive, but I mean as a legitimate tool to be using. So Elijah mocks the prophets of Baal, doesn't he? Paul mocks the grave itself in 1 Corinthians 15. Christ mocks hypocrites. There is a place for mockery. But having said that, I do think that mockery and scoffing, it's a tool which is especially associated with the wicked in the Bible. You see that in the book of Proverbs, for example. Proverbs frequently refers to scoffers and mockers in a very negative way. Proverbs 21:24 says this: "Scoffer is the name of the arrogant, haughty man who acts with arrogant pride." He deserves the title scoffer. That's what he is. That's what he's like. Or you think of Psalm 1 and how Psalm 1 speaks about the seat of scoffers. So mockery, you see, it's associated with the wicked because I think it's cheap and it's nasty. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it, that the scoffer scoffs from his seat. Because scoffing, it's kind of easy, isn't it? It's self-assured. It doesn't require effort. You can sit in your seat and scoff from that position of judgment over somebody else. And mockery, it really bypasses the mind, doesn't it? It doesn't try to argue with you. It tries to take you outside of that whole realm of argument. It wants you to think that the only response you deserve is laughter. And even if you wanted to argue back against it, even if you tried to, you can't really, because you can't easily argue with a joke, can you? You know, when Elisha is mocked in 2 Kings chapter 2, and those young men come out and they say, "Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head." I mean, what's the poor man supposed to say to that? He doesn't have an answer. There isn't an argument he can use in response to that. So mockery, you see, it's cheap and it's nasty. And yet, it is a powerful tool, because it aims straight for the gut. When your opponent is laughing at you, it's disarming, isn't it? It hurts. It makes you feel small. Mockery, ultimately, is an attempt to take that which is threatening and to neutralize it with a joke. It takes that which is big, and it makes it small, it minimizes it with a joke. It takes what is serious and sacred, and it makes it funny with a joke. And mockery, says the Bible, is one of the wicked's weapons of choice against the righteous. I think some of you will have heard me use this example before, but I do think it's pertinent, so I'll say it again. In 2012... Richard Dawkins and several others spoke at the Reason Rally in Washington, D.C. The Reason Rally was an atheist and agnostic conference. They spoke to tens of thousands of fellow atheists and agnostics. And the purpose of this conference was, and I'm quoting, to unify, energize, and embolden secular people. Well, in the course of that rally, Dawkins offers his supporters the following advice when dealing with religious people. He says this: mock them, ridicule them, in public, with contempt. Now, personally, I find it a little bit ironic that a rally which is all about the power of reason would advocate mockery. But as that rally went on, mockery is exactly what took place. The main speakers there weren't the kind of sort of scientists and journalists and those kind of authorities that you might expect. No, they were magicians and comedians, people like Eddie Izzard and Bill Mayer. And no doubt they made all those sorts of jokes about the flying spaghetti monster and all of those other irritating atheist jokes at the time. And just by mentioning that rally, you feel the power of mockery, don't you? It's irritating, it's frustrating, and in large doses, it's demoralizing, it's destabilizing, and it is completely destructive. It seeks to break you down one way or another. It actually seeks to make you sin. Perhaps you've felt that recently. Perhaps you've been mocked. Or maybe you're just very much aware of all the low-level jibing against Christians which goes on in the media, on the chat shows, on the films and the TV dramas, or in the workplace or wherever it might be. Well, if it's any consolation to you, and it should be, Jesus felt all of that mockery as well. When those soldiers look at Jesus in that palace with that silly crown and that silly gown, the sight of him is so stupid that it's actually a form of entertainment to them. They laugh at it. And Jesus would have felt the power of that mockery skewering him, psychologically affecting him. Because like nobody else on this planet, Jesus knows what it's like to be subject to the seat of scoffing. And ultimately, I think we can say it's Satan who is mocking Jesus in this passage. He's the one who behind all of this is intending to break him down and make him sin. He's mocking Jesus to the best of his ability. He's doing it strategically. He's doing it creatively. He's doing it relentlessly. He's laughing at Jesus as hard as he possibly can, making sure that Jesus leaves that palace looking like an utter clown and hoping that he leaves feeling like an utter clown, hoping indeed that the mockery itself might cause him to cave in and to sin. And while he does not sin, we nevertheless mustn't think that Jesus is just impervious to all of this mockery, that it doesn't affect him in any way. No, he's a man. And men, every man, is affected by this kind of thing, psychologically, emotionally. Jesus is a man who has a rich emotional life. He is an emotional man. He has that. He is not a robot, and he feels the effects of this mockery. And that's why I read Psalm 35 at the beginning of this, or one of the reasons why I read it at the beginning of this service, because that psalm talks about that kind of mockery. Those people who gnash their teeth and wink their eye and open their mouths wide and shout, "Aha, aha." And David in that psalm is deeply, deeply distressed. He's upset about all of that. It affects him. I mean, how do you argue back to a set of exposed teeth or a wink or an open mouth? You can't do that. Or you think of Psalm 22, verse 7. David's experience there: all who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. And so when you are mocked as a Christian, whether it's in a little way or a big way, remember, the experience of those psalms finds its richest fulfillment in the experience of Christ himself. Those psalms are his psalms. He is the man who is mocked, and we see that taking place in this passage, in that palace. More than any other man, he can sympathize with you. And he does sympathize. Whatever your condition, wherever you are, if you are a Christian this evening and you know what it is to be mocked, he stands ready to offer you all of the comfort and sympathy that you could possibly want, because he has been through mockery to the greatest extent, worse than anyone else in this world has ever faced. So that's my first point. I'm just observing this mockery, the man who is mocked. But then secondly, I want us to see here the king who chooses to be mocked. The king who chooses to be mocked. I said that this event is a mock coronation service, but my second point this evening, I want us to see that there is actually something deeper going on here, isn't there? You see, we can't help but find ourselves transported when we read this passage, transported back a few chapters, back to that long road which Jesus walked with his disciples to Jerusalem. Because that journey, you remember, was punctuated by three moments. There were three moments on that journey where Jesus very clearly predicted what would happen to him when he arrived at Jerusalem. The first is chapter 8, verse 31. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. The next is chapter 9, verse 31. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. And the third is chapter 10, verse 33, where Jesus says to his disciples, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." And the fact is that by the time we reach chapter 15 and verse 20, apart from the actual dying and the rising, each and every component of those predictions has been fulfilled. In fact, Mark clearly shows us this by using the very same words: handing over, flogging, spitting, mocking. We read those words and we remember that's what Jesus said would happen, and that's precisely what does happen. And so, yes, for all of those disciples who are following along with Jesus along that road to Jerusalem, that might not be what they expected to happen or intended to happen when they got there. But as for Jesus himself, that is precisely what he expected to happen, and indeed, precisely what he intended. Strange though it may sound, being handed over to the Gentiles and flogged and spat on and mocked, that was in fact the very purpose for going to Jerusalem in the first place. And even if Jesus' disciples have this exceptional ability of being able to turn a blind eye to all of that and forget Jesus ever said it, the fact is that Jesus has made it abundantly clear to them. This is his purpose. This is why they're going to Jerusalem. And actually, there's more than that. It's more than just a few predictions Jesus makes on the road to Jerusalem. In those chapters on the road, chapters 8 to 10, Jesus really treats that journey as a whole teaching opportunity for his disciples. And he teaches them about these wonderful themes. Themes of life and death and greatness and humility and kingship and servanthood. And what is Jesus teaching there? Well, ultimately it's this, that true life is found in a willingness to die. Whoever loses his life for my sake and the Gospels will save it, he says. And that true greatness was found in humility. And that true kingship was found in servanthood. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Now, this was a teaching that took all of those disciples' values and expectations victory, success, greatness, and it turned them all inside out. It totally contradicted everything that they were used to. It totally contradicted what the world taught. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, Jesus said, but it shall not be among you. And clearly one of the reasons Jesus was teaching them all of this was because they would soon see these principles clearly demonstrated in the life and death of Jesus himself. As he himself says in chapter 10, "For even the Son of Man, that great cosmic godlike figure, came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And so, my point is this in Mark 15. Mark 15 does show us this mock coronation. Jesus is being stripped of his glory and made to look like a clown. And yet, at the same time, and in a mysterious kind of way, this is a moment of greatness for Jesus. This is a pinnacle. Because this is the very kind of coronation service we now expect to see at the end of that road. This is the kind of coronation which is most befitting of our servant king. The one who is showered in the praises of angels is first showered in mockery and spit. And so this is not just a passage where we see Jesus robbed of his glory, but for us disciples, for us who have been taught along that road to Jerusalem, it's actually a display of his real glory. This is the one whose glory is found first in self-sacrifice, in ultimate service, in giving his very life as a ransom for many. And when we see this then, when we see this passage, we should want to praise this king of ours all the more. He should become all the more glorious, glowing with glory in our sight. That shameful crown of thorns should in its own way become a crown of glory on his head. And that silly mock purple cloak should become in its own way a royal gown of glory. And even that horrible blood-covered cross, as horrible as it is, should become in its own special way a throne of glory. When we look at this passage, this mock coronation, we say, this is our king. And we don't just say those words with outrage. You know, how dare you treat our king like that? No, we say those words with praise and wonder. This is our king, we say, the king who chooses to be mocked. The king who chooses to become servant of all, who chooses to lay down his life for his subjects and to suffer their curse in their place. And in fact, the very emblem of that curse now twists itself around Jesus' head in a crown, doesn't it? A crown of thorns. Thorns, that picture from Genesis chapter 3, that first visual picture of harassment and pain and cursedness which has entered the world because of sin. And Jesus is here being crowned with that pain, crowned with the thorns of human misery. And it's almost as if every time that staff, that reed, comes crashing down upon him in verse 19, those thorns make themselves known again and again as they plunge themselves into his head, as if his very head is made to burn under the pain of the curse itself. And this is his choice. This is his pursuit. This is what he is marching on that road to Jerusalem purposefully towards. This is what makes our king truly great, greater than any of those other tyrants in this world. And so these mockers, they might think they're making Christ a clown, but in a sense, in a greater sense, they are making him truly the king that we will worship. Indeed, this is a king we see here who is more true, more legitimate, more beautiful, more meaningful than any other king we could ever meet in this world. This is a true king, and we meet him in this passage. So the man who is mocked the king who chooses to be mocked. And then thirdly and finally this evening, the God who is not mocked. The God who is not mocked. That's a quote from Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. God is not mocked, Paul says. For whatever one sows, that he will also reap. And the context in Galatians is not the same as the context here. It's different, but the truth there that Paul speaks in those words is timeless, isn't it? Nobody mocks God and gets away with it. And for that reason, then, we fear for those 600 men in that room, because they are handling very, very dangerous material. They don't realize it, but the God of heaven has his eye on that room. He knows every single one of those men. He has heard their laughter against his son. He knows their names. He knows where they live. And he cares about it. The Bible tells us that the Lord always cares when someone is unfairly mocked. In fact, the Lord takes it personally. Proverbs chapter 7, verse 17, verse 5. Whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. But the person in this room is not just poor. He is God's own poor, precious son. And for that reason, we fear for those 600 scoffers, because it cannot possibly end well for them. God does not allow such people to go unpunished. I said before that Psalm 1 talks about those who sit in the seat of scoffers. But actually, in Psalm 2, we meet someone else sitting in another seat, and he too is laughing. Psalm 2, chapter 4, he who sits in the heavens laughs. In Psalm 1, then, it's the wicked man who takes up his little seat and scoffs to himself. But in Psalm 2, we discover he's not the only one laughing. There is another seat, not on earth, but in heaven. And there is laughter coming from that seat as well. God is laughing in Psalm 2. And what's he laughing at in Psalm 2? Well, he's laughing at all the kings and the rulers of the world who resist the Lord's anointed. He's laughing at those who are kicking against the goads, against the Lord's King, the Messiah, Jesus Christ himself. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. You see, in Psalm 2, God looks down at those wicked scoffers themselves, and he sees them plotting against his son. And yet, to him, their attempt to resist King Jesus is so futile, it is actually, for him, tragically funny. In other words, Psalm 2 gives us a window into what is happening in heaven the very moment this scene in this palace is taking place. God is laughing at those Roman soldiers because the joke is on them. Here they are mocking King Jesus, pretending to bow the knee, pretending to pay homage, King of the Jews, and they think they're joking. They think they're being clever, and yet what they don't realize is the joke is on them. Because the very words they use against Jesus, and they think they're being so sarcastic, are actually terribly, terribly true. Because a day is coming when they will really bend the knee, and they will really confess that Jesus Christ is King. Only on that day, they won't be laughing anymore. God will. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. He doesn't just laugh heartily and with delight. He is pained by what happens in that room. He derides those men. But he still laughs. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." God is not mocked. I'm closing now, but as I do so, I want to just draw attention to this purple cloak that they put around Jesus in verse 17. Purple, of course, is associated with luxury. In Luke chapter 16, for example, Jesus tells the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and he says that there's a rich man who is clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. We see the same association in Revelation 18, the citizens of Babylon. Babylon is that symbol of worldly power and wealth, and they're described as living in luxury, and they have purple fabric. And so purple, it's a symbol of luxury. And of course, these people, by putting this robe on Jesus, they're mocking him. It's a joke, because to them, purple is the very last thing that this silly man should be wearing. But what I want to draw your attention to is what happens in verse 20, because it's interesting, isn't it? They strip this purple cloak from Jesus and they put him back in his own clothes. It's almost as if they consider that this purple robe is just a little bit too luxurious to be left on Jesus for too long. It's almost like it was funny for a bit, it was a little joke, but there's a limit to these things, and we can't allow Jesus to keep hold of our lovely purple cloak for too long. We're the ones who deserve the purple robes, not him. And so the passage ends actually with them stripping it back off him and them keeping it presumably to themselves. And I draw that to your attention because I want us to remember that a day is coming when these men will be stripped of their purple robes, so to speak. There is a day coming when all of those who have served earthly luxury will be stripped of their idols and stripped of their purple. Jesus' parable in Luke 16 tells you that. The rich man who starts out clothed in purple doesn't end clothed in purple. He ends facing the judgment of God. And the same is true for Babylon in Revelation 18. Babylon, that symbol of worldliness, ends her days stripped. And we read these words in Revelation 18:15. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and with jewels and with pearls. For in a single hour all this wealth has been laid waste. And so I want to end by saying, I hope you're not a Babylonian this evening. Maybe you are. Maybe to you, life is all about luxury and Jesus is a joke. And maybe you hope that is how it will always be. Well, let me give you a wake-up call. Revelation chapter 18 begs to differ. A day is coming when everything that you have lived for, every pleasure, every item of wealth and luxury will be stripped from you. Please wake up. What you have today will be gone tomorrow. You need to turn to Jesus Christ and realize that he is not the clown that you might want him to be. He is truly the king. But if Jesus is your king this evening, then I have good news. Because Revelation 18, it might describe the fall of Babylon, but it begins with these words. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." Who is the angel in that passage? Who is this angel which comes down from heaven with great authority and calls out in a mighty voice, proclaiming the end of Babylon? Well, I think it is the same man that we meet in Mark chapter 15. And a day is coming then when Jesus Christ will appear to all people on earth. And on that day, his authority will be undeniable. And his appearance won't elicit smirks. It will elicit awe and terror and joy and singing and dancing and worship. Because on that day, whatever beauties Babylon had to boast, whatever art, whatever music, whatever architecture, whatever pleasures, on that day, all of that will be completely outshone. It will be surpassed. And in its stead, Christ will usher in a world of consummate glory. That's what Revelation 18 tells us. Don't we look forward to that day? Doesn't the thought of that day give you peace? On that day, God will be mocked no longer. Please, glory in this King and look forward to the day when you get to see him with your own eyes and see him not in humiliation, but see him in beauty and splendor. Amen.